You're listening to KBOO Portland.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer is...
Tune in to The Dirtbag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty fruits and vegetables in your home garden.
There is a monthly garden stumper, calendar of gardening events. You can even call in with your gardening questions.
That's The Dirtbag every second Wednesday, 11 to 12 a.m. That's on
KBOO
Portland.
Listen, laugh, learn.
The farmer is the man that feeds them all.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, and we're in our annual end-of-year campaign. You can help us meet our $75,000 goal by going to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution today. All donations will be matched up to $20,000 thanks to a generous group of anonymous donors. KBOO's independent programming is only possible with your support. Give now at kboo.fm/give. Thanks so much for your support.
Of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Flashpoints. Today on our show, we begin with an announcement and discussion of what is shaping up to be one of the largest union strikes in history this coming January, hitting all 23 campuses of the California State University system. Then we turn our attention back to the situation in Gaza and a level of barbarity and humanitarian crisis not seen since World War II. Finally, we take a deep dive into how the debate over Gaza has affected academic freedom on university campuses across the United States. I'm Kevin Pina, and we'll be right back with this and more here on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And welcome to another edition of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I'm Kevin Pina, filling in for our executive producer, Dennis Bernstein. Well, most of you probably are aware that this is the end of the fall 2023 semester for a lot of schools, grade schools, community colleges, and universities across the United States and here in California. The real interesting semester for me because I actually got the chance to teach three different kinds of learners. People know I'm a teacher. I think a lot of you know that. I'm just guest hosting here, moonlighting on Flashpoints today. I taught in the Oakland Unified School District a dual enrollment class to high school seniors. I also had the privilege of teaching community college learners at Merritt College. And of course, I teach usually at university level at California State University East Bay. And I bring it up because one of the things that reinforced for me was that the priority really for education, especially in California, which prides itself as an innovative state, for its innovation. The real priority is in the classroom, in the relationship between teachers, instructors, professors, and their students. And I'm reminded of this because I think it's one of the main reasons behind the announcement this week by the California Faculty Association. They are going to shut down the 23 campuses of the California State University system from January 22nd to January 26th. The first week of the spring 2024 semester. And I have to give full disclosure, I am a member of CFA, the California Faculty Association, as well as on the executive board of CFA at East Bay. And so this 23 campus strike is going to affect us locally here in the San Francisco Bay Area as well, where it's going to shut down San Jose State University, San Francisco State University, and of course where I teach, California State University East Bay, nestled in the hills of Hayward, California, not too far from our flagship station, KPFA, here in Berkeley. So joining us today are my two guests who are going to help us understand sort of the evolution of how the largest public university system, how it's come to this moment of strike by the California Faculty Association, and as I understand it, also the Teamsters 210 are also going to be joining in the strike. That's a labor union within the CSU as well. So joining me is Sharon Elise. She's a professor of sociology at California State University, San Marcos, where she conducts research and teaches critical race, black feminism, and qualitative research. Also joining us is Leto Ramos, who's an artist and faculty labor organizer who teaches Chicanx and Central American art and film in the Chicana, Chicano, and Latino, Latina Studies Department of Cal State LA. And Leto, welcome to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. How do you like that for an opening?
Thank you. It's pretty exciting.
How did we get to this moment of shutting down all 23 campuses of the CSU system, system-wide strike, from January 22nd to the January the 26th?
This has been an accumulation of neglect and abuse from CSU management that has brought us to this boiling point, because faculty are at a boiling point of labor militancy that we have not seen in our history. And we have never done this, what we are about to do. But what brought us to this goes all the way back to finding out that we were put on furlough back in 2010 unnecessarily. There was still money, and that we have been held to low salary increases. In our last round of bargaining before this one, we were in the midnight hour of getting a series of raises that were at the final minute set aside because the state budget did not back up the 1% additional raise we were seeking, and so we lost that. And so we learned from that process that agreeing to contingency raises, where they say we're going to give you this percentage if you agree to see if the state budget will support you, is not going to serve our members. It's not going to serve our people.
A big if, right? A big if. It's not guaranteed. It's not guaranteed, right, that the legislature or that the state would fund it.
It's not guaranteed. And we know from the fact that they hold half of our faculty hostage to contingency status that that's a precarious place to be. So whether that's your faculty position or that's your budget, we don't want to agree to precarity. And we know that if we don't push a reset, not just on budgetary items, but also on human rights concerns, that we are going to let the quality of education in this public higher education we call the People's University, we're going to let it plummet. And we are not going to succumb to that. You know, it's really, some could call it a neoliberal plot to try to treat education like a business. We have managers that act like they're running a hedge fund and not a public institution. So we are going to put the brakes on that by shutting it down.
And what about you, Leto?
Sharon said it so well. I think that what all of those things describe is a gross dehumanization of our practice, our teaching practice, for not just for those who are teaching, but for our students. Our students are also being have an increase in their tuition from 6% every year for the next 5 years, 32%. Many of our students are first gen. Many of our faculty are first gen. Many of the faculty are still paying back their loans from their PhDs. So the inequity in our wages are not sustainable. We're living in a time space where this practice of exploitation and class war needs to stop. We need to move into humanistic spaces. We need to look at healing, generating ways and practices that actually make us thrive and not just make us, you know, bots that get exploited. I think it's very clear that, you know, we're moving into space where unless you have a lot of money, you can really survive in a, you know, a thriving way. Most of us get ill by the time we finish teaching, and by the time we finish our grades, some of us are actually then going to the ER. We're going to go and find ways to heal ourselves so that we can make it back to the next semester. That's where we're at. This is not a sustainable humanistic environment, and these are violations of our human rights.
And that's the voice of Leda Ramos. She's from California State University, Los Angeles. And also with us is Sharon Elise. She's at the California State University, San Marcos. We're discussing the announcement by the California Faculty Association of a one-week strike, the first week of the spring 2024 semester, intended to shut down all 23 campuses within the California State University system. Well, guys, let's get to the specifics of what the California Faculty Association has been demanding, that they put on the table here, that management has been ignoring and not accepting.
First and foremost, it should be understood that we're not just going for economic issues, and that we did a survey of members of Unit 3. You needed to be a member of the California Faculty Association to participate. And everybody was able to not just answer, you know, multiple choice questions, but also write in what they see as issues in their environment. So we heard from the diversity of faculty, which includes librarians, coaches, counselors, as well as instructional faculty, and came to understand all the particular things that faculty need to change. So, for example, counseling faculty suffer because we don't have the ratio recommended of one counselor to every 1,000 to 1,500 students. And only three of our campuses meet that ratio. So that means counselors are overburdened with students. And certainly after the pandemic, mental health issues crested and have continued, you know, with a lot of students experiencing depression, anxiety, and other things. And faculty at a loss of how to deal with this because we are not counselors. On top of that, you have faculty needs for remote work. You have workload creep, which we've been trying to address, where they just elevate the numbers of students in the classes gradually. So you suddenly realize, well, I'm teaching 10 more people in every single class. It's like I'm teaching an extra class for the same money. We have suffered really harshly with precarity. More than half of our faculty are considered temporary within our system. Although I will say I worked with one temporary faculty member for over 25 years.
Right.
So it's not really that they are temporary, but being designated as such, they are told every semester that they will have classes if there is a budget to offer those classes. So they really function in an air of uncertainty for years. We had a coach who informed us that he had a different contract every single year for 30 years. And that uncertainty is very hard to live with. On top of that, we're in a state where we've been unable to keep up with inflation. And so in my area, it's typical that people will pay $3,000 a month for a two-bedroom apartment. And when we have faculty working full-time and not making as much as teachers in K-12, they are unable to really afford to live where they teach. And so that's a huge problem. So when we came in, we said we need a double-digit increase, 12% across the board general salary increase. But we also want to fix the broken salary structure where we have people who are living in poverty. And so we want to reset by lifting the floor. So you will hear us call to top the top because management enjoyed 30% increases, all of our college presidents. They have housing allowances of like $90,000 a year or $50,000 a year, car allowances, and our new
on top of their salary, on top of their base salary, right?
$1 million salary.
Mm-hmm. On top of their base salary.
So we're asking 12% and to raise the floor. We're asking to improve working conditions. We're asking for gender-inclusive bathrooms in our buildings so that bathroom use is accessible to our trans faculty and students because faculty working conditions are also student learning conditions. And we need lactation spaces and, you know, accommodations for people who aren't your average white man, which is true for most of our students and faculty now.
Leda Ramos, when we talk about raising the floor for the lowest paid teachers in the California State University system, we're really talking about lecturers, the so-called temporary contingent faculty And I understand the proposal is to raise the base. There are these different grades of pay. There's grade A and there's grade B. And these are the lowest paid of those lecturers. And in order to keep and attract and to maintain talented faculty, the CFA has proposed to lift up those base salaries. Yes?
Yes, absolutely. The inequity in our wages is extreme. Our tenure faculty are not paid well by any means, but then you get into the majority of faculty on any CSU campus or any university in the United States, which are lecturers. We're also called adjunct faculty. We're also called contingent faculty, temporary faculty, a lot of, you know, really dismissive terms. We are faculty. One of the things I love about CFA is that we are all faculty, tenure, tenure track, and lecturer. And we are, you know, bit by bit trying to dismantle this two-tiered system, which turns into an incredibly disrespectful space. I, for example, have an MFA, which is considered a terminal degree. And after, you know, I'm at Cal State LA for 7 years, I make $65,000 a year. After taxes, I'm in the $50,000 a year. I have a colleague who teaches four classes with a PhD, four classes, which is nearly full time. She makes $50,000 a year. Mm. After taxes, she's making $42,000 a year. How is she supposed to live, pay back her student loans, and live in Los Angeles on between $42,000 to $50,000 a year?
It's interesting because I heard that, and now I know that the administration came back with a 15% counteroffer, right? That's what we're really discussing here. CFA wanted 12% across the board, GSI, but the administration management of the CSU came back with 15%, which they're touting as 3% higher than what CFA was demanding. But as you rightfully said, there's no guarantee because it's contingent upon the state legislature and the governor's office maintaining a budget to sustain 10% of that raise. So really it's just a 5% raise, right?
So this is not opening of the whole contract. We're only bargaining on four articles, and then they brought in a fifth, and we want this to conclude for 1 year, because then we want to open up the contract and we want to look at other things like appointment and evaluation, you know, and some things we didn't even look at this time.
Well, let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and those are the voices of my two guests, Sharon Elise. She's a professor of sociology at California State University, San Marcos, and she is a tenured professor there. And Leda Ramos, who is a lecturer, contingent faculty at California State University, Los Angeles. Just, you know, here in the Bay Area, I know that our local chapter has, you know, collaborated with our members, have not as an organization, but kind of, you know, as union members, proud union members, we've gone and we supported the California Nurses Association strike, the Kaiser strike, different labor struggles in the Bay Area. I'm also a member of the Peralta Federation of Teachers, which is the community college district within the East Bay. We are going to be asking the membership, not the unions themselves, because we can't do that, to come to our picket line and help us, you know, join us, all of the local San Francisco Bay Area labor members, union members, to come to our picket January 22nd through the 26th at California State University in the hills of Hayward, California. Are you guys doing something similar? Are you reaching out to local labor to kind of build the numbers and build that strength, you know, from the local community as well?
At Cal State LA, we have a labor council. And so we have been in solidarity with all the labor unions on our campus. And I know other campuses are doing the same. We are with the Teamsters, CSUEU, and more. And so we have worked with the LA Labor Fed. We have delegates in the LA Labor Fed. So we, and also many of the faculty, are social justice community activists. So we are part of many organizing unions and groups, Black Lives Matter Grassroots, Chirla, Carecen. There's so many groups that we work with regularly in our practice, in our both our scholar activist practice. So we work with many artists, poets, writers, it's everything. So this is a solidarity summer in labor union organizing that moved into a solidarity fall. We sit, Calcule, right next to a school, LACSA, which probably has a large percentage of SAG union worker parents who just finished a long strike. And so they are with us, the students are with us, unions are with us, and this is a solidarity strike.
And of course, we have the Teamsters, Local 210, on all our campuses, who are also going to be part of this, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Teamsters are hardcore.
And then, of course, yeah, they are. I saw those folks at the chancellor's office.
I mean that in all the best ways. They will show out. They'll be walking the picket lines with us. And we really appreciate their solidarity with us. And we are in solidarity with them.
So what's Sharon, what's the next step in the bargaining process? It's a possibility that this strike could be averted if CSU management and the Board of Trustees came to the table and really listened to the demands of CFA. This could be over, right?
Absolutely. And so it's almost like we're planning for peace and preparing for war, right? So at the same time that we have to, you know, work through our short holiday break, and some of us will have to work right through that to begin preparing to strike. And at the same time, we also have dates to meet with the CSU management bargaining team and going back to the table with them. So it's important to be in conversation to try to find if there's ways that we can meet each other part way. But, you know, we have a commitment, you know, that we are going to raise the floor, and they have been reticent to talk about that. We have a commitment that we want to deal with the police militarized presence on our campuses and to at least make sure that faculty rights are respected in those processes, and they have been unwilling to really engage in conversation about that. There are some things that they could change that would not cost them a dime. They're reticent to talk about. And then in terms of the things that cost them money, we had a fiscal accountant from Business University in Michigan, Howard Bunces, told us that they could make every single request of ours economically without touching their more than $8 billion in reserves.
They have the money.
They would not touch.
Wow.
So they have the money. They just don't have the inclination right now, and we need to bring it to them.
And that's a voice of Sharon Elise. She's a professor of sociology at California State University, San Marcos. We're talking about the upcoming California Faculty Association and Teamster Local 210 strike in the California State University system, all 23 campuses, January 22nd through January 26th. Well, I'm going to give you the last word, Leda. What do you want to leave us with? How should we be looking at this? What should we be watching for? How can we help?
Solidarity and our allies, people in who, if you've ever benefited from a CSU, and I mean that in a very comprehensive, holistic way. If you know somebody who graduated from a CSU, if the nurse that you went to a CSU, if the teacher you had went to a CSU, if the poet whose poetry you love to read went to a CSU, for all the different places that people have spread and the seeds of their growth and their learning through the CSUs, if any of us have been touched by that, please join us, please support us. Because we are strong, but we need even more love to kind of wrap this whole thing up.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there again. That's Leda Ramos. She's at California State University, Los Angeles. And our other guest, Sharon Elise, professor of sociology at California State University, San Marcos. Guys, thanks so much for sharing this with us today, our listeners on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you so much. Huelga.
Huelga.
And let's go ahead and take a break here. When we get back, we're going to talk to Nora Barrows-Friedman, former producer here on Flashpoints, now the associate editor at the Electronic Intifada. We'll be back with that and more here on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
because now it's Christmas and I want everything. I just can't wait. Christmas, so don't stop spending. I want a million gifts, that's right. Don't forget my Christmas list tonight.
Welcome back to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's my little ode to unsustainable consumer capitalism. So now let's go ahead and take a little segue that'll give me whiplash. We're going to talk about something far more serious, namely the horrific situation continuing to challenge the Palestinian people in Gaza. Again, joining us is former Flashpoints producer Nora Barrows-Friedman, currently the associate editor for the Electronic Intifada, which can be heard here on Flashpoints. Nora, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thanks so much, Kevin.
Well, I know these are difficult times. I know that you stay on top of what's happening in Gaza. Let's just start with this question of the humanitarian crisis. Horrible. What we're hearing are horrific situations confronting a large majority of the population in Gaza today.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty unfathomable. Not just is, you know, Israel is not just carpet bombing and leveling apartment buildings. Today they bombed something like 50 houses at once, and they, you know, wiped out an entire neighborhood, and that is unrelenting. And so people are not just being killed by airstrikes or snipers, or they have these new sniper drones outfitted with gun on them. But people are also dying of starvation and dehydration. And then we have communicable diseases. The Palestinian Ministry of Health in Gaza has estimated that more than 350,000 cases right now.
Unbelievable.
Of communicable diseases, diarrhea, skin infections, things like meningitis and chicken pox and skin rashes and hepatitis are ripping through mostly the shelters in which, you know, thousands and thousands of people are huddled very close together with almost no, you know, there's no bathrooms, there's no sanitation, there's no medicine. And these shelters are also being hit by Israeli airstrike. And so people are like, it is unimaginable, Kevin. This is all part and parcel of Israel's genocidal plan to exterminate Palestinians in Gaza. The ones they don't exterminate, they want to push out into the Sinai Peninsula and into Egypt. And nobody is stopping them. The Biden administration is resupplying them with artillery shells and bunker buster bombs and God knows what else. And Israel is enacting this genocide on all fronts.
Well, let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and that's the voice of our guest today, Nora Barrows-Friedman. She's the associate editor of the Electronic Intifada. We're discussing the situation, the humanitarian situation on the ground in Gaza, as well as, you know, the weaponry that you listed. We've all seen these reports of even anti-personnel weaponry being used, and largely, how on earth, given the situation, how can they justify the slaughter of the civilian population when they're claiming that this is war? This is not war. I think that you use the right word. It's genocide.
Yeah, it is genocide. By all, you know, by all accounts, by all definitions, this is textbook genocide. And Israel has enjoyed complete impunity. I've said that on this program many, many times for many, many years. And we're really seeing what that looks like. It's not just, you know, legal impunity where, you know, Israel gets to commit war crimes every single minute for 75 years and not be held accountable or responsible. But every definition of genocide that you can, you know, find in, you know, any sort of like legal convention is being committed right now as well. Over the past 9 weeks in Gaza, 10 weeks, Israel has committed genocide. And it's not, and as I said, it's not just, you know, the ungodly amount of artillery and weapons, but it is also the weapon of starvation, the weapon of dehydration, the weapon of the elimination of antibiotics. antibiotics. There are no antibiotics in Gaza.
Well, what about the humanitarian response? Is there not a major humanitarian response happening?
I mean, no. You know, all these humanitarian aid trucks that are coming in through the southern Gaza crossing is literally, it's like a fraction of a percent of what Gaza needs to basically survive. You know, the amount of aid that is needed is not what we're seeing being delivered. And the Biden administration gets to say, we are in a John Kirby, right, walking on the White House lawn a couple weeks ago saying we're doing everything we can to minimize civilian casualties and get humanitarian aid to the people who need it most. The people who need it most are already dead because John Kirby and the Biden administration, Antony Blinken and right. You know, the entire cabinet has decided that Israel can kill as many people as it wants. And there is no red line that Israel can cross. It's not 20,000 people dead, half of them children. It's not starvation. It's not dehydration. It's not cutting off of all electricity. It's not cutting off of medicine and antibiotics and bandages. It defies all sort of logic. Logic does not apply to this situation. Those have to justify it.
Those people who will say that this is a response, a legitimate response by Israel to the attack of Hamas, there's no way, when you talk about proportionality, right, there's these rules of war that say that a proportion of a military response is not to exceed the attack that was met upon one nation or another. I mean, there's no sense of any proportionality here, given what you're describing.
No, not at all. I mean, when you look at the amount of hospitals that Israel has targeted in the last 10 weeks, there are, you know, something like 36 hospitals across the Gaza Strip that serve 2.3 million people. Every single one of those hospitals has either been destroyed by bombs, put out of service because Israel has cut off all, you know, electricity and water, or they've come in and they've surrounded these hospitals with snipers and tanks. They storm inside the hospitals. They snipe patients and medical staff and their families and people who are trying to find shelter in the hospital courtyards. Just a few days ago, I think it was Saturday, the Israeli military ran bulldozers over people inside tents in the hospital courtyard at Kamal Adwan Hospital in Khan Yunus, which is in the south, who were displaced and who were sheltering. And Israeli bulldozers ran them over and stormed the hospital. And they've arrested hundreds of medical staff, including the directors of most of the major hospitals in up and down Gaza, interrogating them, forcing them to falsely confess to crimes that are completely absurd in order to, you know, quote unquote, justify the continuous attack on hospitals. Just this morning, I was watching Al Jazeera and a reporter was reporting on the situation. And in the background, you saw an Israeli airstrike over a Kuwaiti hospital, the Kuwaiti hospital in southern Gaza. I mean, these are war crimes that are being caught on camera. And nobody is stopping Israel. Nobody who has any, you know, in the West, who has power to stop these bombs from exploding over the heads of patients and children and men and women in Gaza, is doing anything. I mean, the proportionality, it's never existed when we talk about the Israeli settler colonial
project.
Right,
even before this, we've seen horrendous footage, images, reports of the treatment of Palestinians by the IDF. Yeah. Brutal treatment.
I mean, it's unimaginable. It's unspeakable, the level of brutality and psychotic terrorism that Israel engages in and has engaged in for the last, you know, 75 years. And this is the culmination of that project. This is the culmination of the allowing by the so-called international community Israel to enact this project of settler colonialism, of apartheid, and of brutal genocide of Palestinians and ethnic cleansing over the last 100 years.
And again, this is Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and that's the voice of Nora Barrows Friedman. She's the associate editor of the Electronic Intifada. We're talking about the situation in Gaza, confronting the people that who live there now in the face of Israeli atrocities. There's no other way that I can describe it. I've also just seen the list of journalists that they have targeted. Children, everybody.
Everybody is a target in Gaza. Yeah, 100 journalists. 100 journalists. I mean, Israel is so good at breaking records for the amount of people in any profession that it massacres, whether it's journalists or physicians or teachers or librarians or fathers, mothers.
Children.
I mean, they are just, everybody in Gaza is a target, and the world is letting Israel do this every single hour of every single day over the last 10 weeks.
But we have seen massive protests internationally, haven't we? We have seen that there is at least the faith and goodwill and understanding of the majority of people in Europe, in even in the United States. We've seen massive demonstrations across several cities. So that's something anyway, right? I mean, it's not stopping it. Certainly Biden is now, we're hearing in the polls, he's concerned that younger voters won't vote for him now because of his allowing and enabling Israel to continue this genocidal operation.
Right. I mean, yeah, this is going to be Biden's legacy. He is ideologically intertwined with Israel's genocidal project.
Has there ever been a U.S. government that wasn't actually? I mean,
exactly. That's right.
Really?
I mean, this is just continuing the tradition of U.S. presidents who are enabling, aiding and abetting Israel's settler colonial project.
Well, let's talk a little bit about AIPAC. You know, what about AIPAC? You know, that for the folks who don't know, AIPAC is the lobbying organization for the Israeli government in the United States. We know that they have kept a very close rein and watch over U.S. legislators in the Senate, in the Congress. They've contributed to them. It's a PAC, right? Isn't it really? It's also a PAC as well as a political organization. And then you've got the ADL in addition, which is sort of the censorship patrol now, right? When you say genocide in Gaza, all of a sudden you hear that that's anti-Semitic.
Right. No, the words are meaningless at this point. The lobby organizations, just as the defense contractors, they're very excited. You know, Silicon Valley companies, they're very excited about wars and occupations because they make a lot of money. It's a big profit-making endeavor. You know, AIPAC has been supportive of lawmakers who help Israel do what it wants. The ADL is a far right lobby organization that masquerades as a civil rights group. It is one of the most racist and deranged organizations out there that, as you said, it is now just a censorship arm in service to the Israeli government and the Zionist project. And the ADL is, they're trying to say that, like, you know, anti-Semitic incidents have risen, 300%, since October 7th in the U.S. And when you look at their statistics and their data, what they count as quote unquote anti-Semitic incidents are like candlelight vigils for Palestinian children, protests on campuses calling for the end to the bombing, petitions for a ceasefire, like things that should be just like nominally, like these are baseline humanist sort of positions. If you have a soul,
right,
if you have morals and ethic, you wouldn't want children to be bombed.
That's right.
And yet the ADL has been able to twist words into meaningless, concepts where suddenly calling for an end to slaughtering children is tantamount to anti-Jewish bigotry, which is very dangerous, obviously, because it renders that term meaningless at a time when white supremacist groups and actual Nazi organizations here in the U.S. and abroad are becoming more powerful. And so, like, equating criticism of the Israeli government with anti-Jewish bigotry is a very dangerous, ideology, and it must be confronted and stopped, but they keep doing it anyway. And, but also, like, these tactics, as you said, like, there's so much activism right now in support of justice for Palestinians and for an end to the slaughter, and not just for things to go back to the status quo, but there are polls where, young people, voter voting age people are not just saying, you know, they disagree with Biden. They're not going to vote for Biden because he's supporting and aiding and abetting this genocide. But they're also very clear that what needs to happen is that Palestinians need to achieve justice. And what that means is an end to the occupation, a restoration of their basic human rights, and the right of return to their land that has been taken from them for 75 years. That is the only way that Palestinians will be able to start to begin to regain justice. And young people understand that, and that it goes completely against the grain of U.S. policy is really significant. And the Democrats should be freaking out. They shouldn't. But instead of, you know, doing the thing that they should be doing to earn votes, which is to stop this genocide and to support the Palestinian liberation struggle, they're doubling down on going harder and harder to the right. And that's not going to work out well for anybody. It's just like mind-boggling. I'm just like, how does this keep happening? What have we become? Who are we? Why can't we see what's happening in front of our faces? It's startling.
And again, that's the voice of Nora Barrows Friedman. She is the associate editor of the Electronic Intifada. We're talking about the situation in Gaza. Because we referenced AIPAC and ADL earlier, folks who don't know, AIPAC stands for the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, and the ADL is the Anti-Defamation League. Nora, I also got to say, I've also seen some of the vitriol that our executive producer here on Flashpoints, Dennis Bernstein, has received as a result of just what I consider to be conscious, fair reporting about the situation, hearing different views. How can you respond to someone who calls someone who's a journalist trying to do his job a self-hating Jew? I don't get that, right? It's vitriol. On one hand, we're supposed to raise to a higher standard, but somehow they can resort to ad hominem attacks against journalists and other people who oppose the Israeli policies and U.S. enabling, arming, funding Israeli policies.
I mean, that's all they have. They don't have the facts. They don't have, you know, history and context on their side. So all they have is resorting to attacks and smear campaigns and attempts at censorship and attempts at character assassination or literal assassination. That's all they have. It's revolting, and we shouldn't give their smears and attacks any oxygen. I try not to. I mean, you wouldn't believe what my...
I believe it.
What my mentions look like.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay, because that's, if you're pissing off the right people, then you're doing a good job as the journalist. If you're making, you know, people who are racist and genocidal angry, then you're doing a good job. And I think that's why Israel has been targeting relentlessly the brave, heroic Palestinian journalists on the ground in Gaza at a pace that we've never seen before. It's slaughter. And these journalists, they have more courage in their pinky finger than the entire Israeli military has. The Al Jazeera journalist, Wael Dahdouh, whose family was slaughtered weeks ago.
The entire family, yeah.
Entire family, including his children. He got up the next day and he kept reporting. And just a few days ago, his cameraman was assassinated by Israel. And he got up, and he was injured. Wael was injured. And the next day, Wael got up, and he kept reporting, and he keeps reporting. I mean, because he knows they're never going to break the dignity of Palestinians. They're not going to break the courage and the steadfastness. And for these heroic, some of them are young. I mean, some of these journalists are in their early 20s, and they've had to grow up so fast, and they are living through the most terrifying, traumatizing period of their lives, and they keep reporting because that's what they are, that's what they've committed to do. And they're not going to let Israel silence them. They're not going to let Israel make them cower into fear, make them censor themselves. These are the bravest people, and they're just, you know, a fraction of the population in Gaza who are, every single one of them are brave and dignified, and they are trying to defend themselves against the most brutal, vicious, psychotic army in modern times.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, Nora Barrows Friedman. You know, one of those popular slogans that I've been hearing across college and university campuses in the United States is, "In November, we'll remember." And,
that's right.
You know, we'll see how that turns out. Yeah. I don't think people are going to forget this easily. I mean, it's still going on. So how could we? Right. Nora, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your perspective today here on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Thanks for covering it, Kevin.
All right, let's go ahead and take another break here. The name of the song is called Justice for Christmas. You won't hear it anywhere else, but here on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And again, that's Supernatural. Back from the days of Occupy Oakland. Name of the tune is Justice for Christmas. A light in the mood, but make sure the message was on point. And continuing the discussion of the fallout, if you will, from the situation in Gaza, college universities and campuses across the United States have been grappling with the issue of academic freedom. It's related to this discussion of the political climate where now to be critical of Israel and of what's happening in Gaza is somehow being associated by organizations like the Anti-Defamation League as being anti-Semitic. So it doesn't take very much in this kind of climate to be accused of such. However, we know that the traditions of academia have been that in order to have full discourse, it requires the kind of freedom that allows for open inquiry. My guest today is Ryan Quinn. He is the faculty issues reporter with Inside Higher Ed, Inside Higher Education. Ryan, welcome to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Well, did I kind of describe that right? The sort of climate that we're in today when it comes to academic freedom?
I think it's fair to say that there have been, since the October 7th attack on Israelis and then the subsequent Israeli bombardments of Gaza, which have killed civilians in droves, we have seen at least reports of increasing numbers of faculty members who are either being censored, investigated, or even punished for their speech about the Israel-Palestine war. It's hard to actually come by, concrete numbers on this. It seems like a lot of these organizations, these free speech advocacy organizations, academic freedom advocacy organizations that I spoke with, they don't have concrete numbers on how much these encroachments onto free speech and academic freedom, how much this issue has actually increased since October 7th. But certainly they're hearing tons of reports. I'm hearing tons of reports just reading news articles in other states. And it certainly seems that something is going on here.
Well, Jesus, when one of the presidents of an Ivy League university at UPenn has to resign because they consider her to be equivocating, a conservative in Congress, questions her and says she's equivocating on whether or not Hamas should be condemned and that that, you know, that that there that that her lack of doing so verged on anti-Semitism. I'd say that's a pretty, you know, that's a pretty identifiable impact, right?
Certainly, but that's one of my questions here is that I'm still trying to figure out is, you know, how much does this expand beyond the Ivy League, right? And certainly in my story I wrote, there were examples from the Ivy League, Yale, Cornell, but there were also examples outside of the Ivy League. But you know, a lot of higher education journalism, and especially when the national media gets involved in reporting on higher education, a lot of it seems to hyper-focus on the Ivy Leagues. And sometimes I wonder how much of a phenomenon is something like this beyond the Ivy Leagues. That's not to say that just because it happens at Ivy League doesn't mean it's important, right? I mean, these are some of the most powerful institutions.
And they get the most press.
And they get the most press. But yes, I did also see it at there are examples at colleges that many people may have never heard of, like Ramapo College of New Jersey. I mean, this is certainly, there are anecdotes beyond the Ivy League of this happening. We just don't know how statistically how much it's increased, because you know, the Israel-Palestine conflict has always been a source of academic freedom fights, as long as I can remember, on campuses. It just seems like things have really kicked into overdrive since October 7th, I think understandably, in these fights. And you now have, unlike most campus controversies, you now have even national politicians getting involved, and in some cases international politicians getting involved. I think that there was a message from an Israeli politician to American university presidents on what they should do. So this level of attention to this is unprecedented, I think.
And let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and that's the voice of our guest, Ryan Quinn. He's a faculty issues reporter for Inside Higher Ed. He's also worked as a journalist for a number of years. Where else have you worked, Ryan, real quickly?
I worked for the Charleston Gazette Mail, which is in West Virginia. So when I came to Inside Higher Ed, I found myself reporting again on West Virginia, because WVU became famous nationwide for laying off scores of of tenured faculty, including tenured ones.
Well, let's take a step back to move forward here. Let's just talk about the sort of concept of academic freedom. It really is about creating an open environment where intellectual inquiry can happen in an honest way, where people can make mistakes, where I'm thinking of the tradition of forensic rhetoric, for example, right? People often would argue outlandish positions that they didn't agree with, because through that process, learning occurred, right? There was a type of inquiry and querying and rigor that came out of it that led intellectual pursuits forward. And now it seems as if that's no longer the priority. And I think of that particularly in the context, we're not just talking about overt censorship, which I believe is occurring, but we're also talking about a climate, a political climate, that creates self-censorship among leading academics.
Yes, and I think to your point here, even if we don't have concrete numbers on it, the impression created certainly is that faculty members should stay quiet about this issue, about the war. And I think the impression is that they should stay quiet if they want to speak up for Palestinians. They should stay quiet about that, or else they're going to face consequences. That's certainly through all of these reports that are coming up across the nation of I reported on the National Communication Association had a situation in which the National Communication Association, some leaders there, it's still unclear who, apparently asked a Palestinian professor at UC San Bernardino to not speak about the war in the presidential address given by another Palestinian professor, the first Palestinian president of the National Communication Association. They said that this professor could not say that what was happening was a genocide in Gaza, could not say that as part of this presidential address to the National Communication Association, or else they'd cancel the entire award ceremony at this conference.
Wow.
These examples just keep coming up, and I guess we're going to see them for a while now.
Well, ultimately, you know, some of this is going to be also grieved, right? Because there are faculty unions that also will back up the rights, academic rights, academic freedom for their professors, for their union members. I wonder, where have the productions gone? Why is there so much of this occurring, given that I thought there were guardrails, right? That we had a tradition of guardrails to protect academic freedom in this country.
Well, my feeling is that the guardrails still exist, though they are weakened. It's just that the pressure that's being put upon those guardrails is so much higher than what has existed in the past. I mean, we got to remember that this is a current war on probably the most explosive foreign policy issue in American foreign policy and maybe international foreign policy, involving two minority groups on campuses, sometimes protesting against each other. You've got donors applying pressure. You've got alumni applying pressure. You've got parents applying pressure. You've got the Republican Party applying pressure. You have the Democratic president, in some sense, applying pressure. I mean, he came, I guess his spokesman or one of his representatives came out after the president's congressional hearing criticizing what they had said. So in some way, you have bipartisan pressure in support of Israel here. And so I think that just some of these guardrails that do still exist but have been weakened over time through things like, you know, the decline in the share of tenured faculty, resulting lack of shared governance and institution. Some of these weakened guardrails are actually being buffeted by an unprecedented amount of political pressure going all the way up to the top of the federal government.
Again, that's the voice of our guest, Ryan Quinn. He's the faculty issues reporter for Inside Higher Education. We're going to have to leave it there, Ryan. Fascinating discussion. I'm going to continue reading your work.
Thank you.
That wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. Special thanks to producer and engineer Rod Akeel. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or
you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone.
KBOO Community Radio is listener supported. That's right, 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. Right now, during our annual end-of-year campaign, your support can go even farther. Contribute today at kboo.fm/give, and your donation will be matched dollar for dollar, up to $20,000, thanks to the generous support of a group of anonymous donors. Maximize the impact of your support for KBOO right now.
Tune in every second and fourth Saturday night.